Listen, Dad, are mobile suits more important to you than human beings?
It almost looks like this mobile suit is shaking in terror.
It's a mobile suit!
Amuro, is that you inside that mobile suit?
Let's just see. Let's test the reaction time of your brand new mobile suit.
You alone are responsible for the mobile suit now. Is that understood?
These are the days when you wish your bed was already made.
It's just another
mobile suit.
Monday. Wish it was Sunday. That's math.
Farmer O'Ray.
I don't have to run day. It's just another
mobile suit.
Monday.
Amuro Ray.
Mobile suit.
In war, to keep the upper hand, you have to think two or three moves ahead of the enemy.
Hey guys, welcome back to a Zaku-rific episode of Fanholes Mobile Suit Mondays. Hey, what's up, guys? This is Derek, Derek WC. I'm going to be one of your hosts tonight, and I am joined tonight by two, count them, two of my fellow Zeon enthusiasts. Why don't you guys give a shout out and let everybody know who's here tonight?
Hey, it's Mike, and before we record this podcast, I think we should all seal ourselves in some plastic film just to be on the safe side.
Because that's normal. It's a normal suit.
Yep. Normal.
And this is Justin, Zig Zeon.
All right, so we are here, we are back to discuss our ongoing coverage of the original Mobile Suit Gundam anime. We are now on episode 5, which is titled Re-Entry to Earth, and the original Japanese air date was May 5th, 1979. And just for those folks who are keeping track at home, that Ocean Group dub that we like to point out so much and normally listen to, that was released, the English air date on Cartoon Network was July 27th, 2001. And of course, we open with the same kind of introduction to the setup of the show and the whole 1 year war. And we see the title card that says Re-entry to Earth. And we open up on them a pan from the Earth Sphere itself to White Base. And it is in re-entry orbit, escorted by the Federation ship Salamis. While Frau Bo is handing out towels to the refugees to, quote-unquote, freshen up, Amuro steps in to help out a boy and his grandfather repair his remote control car. As they exchange stories on the 1 week war, since the boy lost his parents here and was with the grandfather ever since, Amuro, of course, mentions that with luck, his mother should be waiting for him back on Earth. I don't know if we want to talk about this or not, but I did write down or copy some stuff on what they talk about as like the 1 week war or the 1 week battle. But basically, like that's kind of what they talk about in the intro to some degree. But there's a bunch of stuff on it, which I thought was kind of interesting, where they just said the Principality of Zeon launched a surprise attack against Side 1, Side 2, and Side 4 on January 3rd, Universal Century 0079. Attacking a mere 3 seconds after officially declaring war, a fact that was sardonically referred to as the 3-second warning, the Zeon used their mobile suit forces to eliminate Earth Federation Space Force resistance before killing the civilian inhabitants of a number of colonies with poison gas. In this manner, an approximately unknown amount of space noids were killed by Zeon forces. So that would be probably where this little kid lost his mother and father and ended up with his grandfather and stuff like that. And then the write-up goes on to say, this period of initial slaughter became known as the 1 week battle or 1 week war. It was during this time that Side 6 declared its neutrality in the conflict. The peak of the 1 week battle was Operation British, which took place on January 10th, Universal Century 0079, where the Zeon forces used the depopulated colony cylinder Side 2, Bunch 8 Isle Ifish in an attempt to destroy the Earth Federation Force's main headquarters, Jaburo. Though the Earth Federation Space Force has dispatched a fleet of their surviving warships in an attempt to stop the operation, the Zeon military successfully defended the colony, and the Earth Federation Space Forces was forced to withdraw after taking near-total losses. Upon entering the atmosphere, however, Isle Ifish broke apart, missing Jaburo, but causing widespread destruction across the Earth. The largest remaining piece of the colony, consisting of approximately the entire front half, hit Sydney, Australia, which of course ties into the intro we see every episode and kind of what we set up in the first episode where we covered this show. But I just thought that'd be worth going into as far as, you know, sometimes you see stuff and you kind of wonder what they're talking about. And also, I always kind of remember thinking to myself, like, it's cool sounding, I suppose, when they say, oh, this is the 1 week battle or the 1 year war. But like, sometimes I think about like actual history, and I'm sure maybe Justin can back me up on this, but it's like, I don't know too many wars that like were so short, but I suppose it's supposed to be an indication of maybe technology or something, so it happens a lot quicker, or I don't know, but it's just one of those things that was always in the back of my head, like maybe it sounds cool, but maybe that's an aspect of it that's not quite as realistic as they want in a real robot genre.
They always say like each side lost half its respective population, so maybe it was like, yeah, just so devastating to their populations, basically.
Right, that it happened within, you know, a small period of time, just within like a week or a month or something like that. Yeah, definitely.
And for like, for real history, there was a six-day war like in 67. I think it was like a Arab-Israeli conflict that only lasted 6 days, so like, you know, there is some like precedence for like that kind of like quick kind of conflict.
Yeah. Okay. So we've got that, and then I guess the actual episode continues on where the grandfather is showing Amuro how he used to grow coffee beans in South America, and he literally like takes the coffee beans, like I guess he's been carrying them in his pocket this whole time when he left Earth all the way to, you know, the side and outer space and everything, and now he still has them in his pocket. You'd think they'd be pretty musty or moldy by this point, but they're not. And he makes a vow to stay on Earth once they land, no matter what comes his way. You know, he kind of predicts either that, you know, the Zeon forces may attack him when he ends up on Earth, or maybe Federation soldiers would try to drive him off of the Earth because he was a colonist, and, you know, maybe they don't want him back there. But he basically says, you know, come hell or high water, you know, now that I'm a refugee and I'm headed back to Earth, like, nobody's gonna move me off of the planet anymore. We cut then to Bright on the bridge, and Bright is asking Mirai if she can handle re-entry into Earth's atmosphere, and she pretty much believes that she can do that, but she's kind of concerned about Char's Musai cruiser in the background. And Bright tells her to concentrate on the re-entry. The plan is to follow a capsule from the Salamis, that's the ship that was escorting the White Base into the Earth's atmosphere, and then let Bright worry about Char and the Musai cruiser. Then we get introduced to Lieutenant Reed of the Salamis, and he comes up on the comm screen. He's confirming re-entry procedures and basically tells Bright and his team to keep up. I guess I'll open it up to you guys, but I did want to make the comment that I always kind of think it's funny. Like, I get why Mirai has something, like, basically it's like a Capri Sun. Like, they have all these sort of astronaut / kind of drinks when they're on White Base. And, you know, she's basically drinking kind of astronaut style, so I guess the orange juice doesn't go floating around all over the place or whatever. And I assume that's the reason why it's being done. But I always found it kind of funny that, like, people feel the need to talk while they have a straw in their mouth. Like, I don't know what that is, but, like, I'm like, either you drink the fucking drink or you talk, but it just seems funny. Like, it's lazy. Like, I'm not going to take the straw out of my mouth. That would be too much work. I guess also it might be worth mentioning that Lieutenant Reed, I believe, is voiced by Scott McNeil at this point. So he's making like a comeback in sort of a side role there and everything. The other thing that I thought was interesting is at this point, I didn't noticed this in the past, or maybe I wasn't looking at this all with a critical eye, but, you know, as I tend to do on these, I'm watching like the ocean dub, the Japanese language version, and then seeing how it sort of compares with the movie version. And in this case, not necessarily the movie dub so much, but just the differences between the movie version and the TV version. And what I thought was kind of interesting is this is finally the point, I think, in the movie where, like, obviously they're splicing together and making a compilation film out of the existing episodes, you know, the whole 43 episodes of Mobile Suit Gundam. But in this case, like, certain scenes were reanimated, and I believe the conversation with Lieutenant Reed on the comm is one of those scenes where, like, Bright looks kind of, I don't know, quote-unquote cooler. Like, he looks more 1981 than, you know, 1979 or something like that. I don't know how to describe it other than that, but there is that aspect where as we go through this episode, like, many of the images of, like, Char talking to the troops and things like that are all kind of reanimated, just little bits of it where they look a little more Zeta than original Mobile Suit Gundam, if that makes any sense.
Like, sometimes when you watch the movie versions, yeah, it's like, I'm kind of like, I know I was surprised when I watched them again, and I was kind of like, I don't remember, like, the animation being that good. And then, like, if you look back at the episode, it's like, oh, it wasn't. That was, like, a new, like, they probably animated that for the movie, basically.
Yeah, it seems like maybe, you know, if you compare, like, Char Aznavour to Wolverine or something and say, like, Char's got that strong Japanese fan aura, it seems like he got a lot of touch-ups in the movie animation as well, and there were just certain sequences, especially related to this episode, where I finally, you know, I, since we're looking at it with a more critical eye, I mean, it's pretty obvious when you watch the different versions back to back and kind of compare them, you're like, oh, this is where, you know, this is where, you know, this sequence was reanimated.
Speaking of Wolverine, I couldn't help, I think you compared Bright to, like, Cyclops in an earlier episode that we talked about, so I couldn't help but think that Lieutenant Reed was being, like, his Wolverine, like, not only because he was voiced by Scott McNeil, but just because he was giving Bright, like, a hard time, basically. Like, it's like, you bunch of kids here, bub, like, you bunch of amateurs here. Like,
well, it's interesting because you probably tend to forget pretty quickly because, you know, Bright is in command at this point, and, you know, throughout the course of the whole Gundam franchise, you know, he's often at the helm of a ship, you know, taking charge and everything like that. But you kind of forget in this, and I think Lieutenant Reed serves as a reminder. You know, he kind of calls him kid most of the time. He's like, hey, kid, we're going into reentry and all this stuff. And, you know, in some ways, you know, maybe it's reminiscent of Harrison Ford calling Mark Hamill a kid, but at the same time, it also kind of reminds you, even though this guy is the interim captain, he's only 19 years old. Like, he was like an ensign cadet type guy before all this shit went down, basically. So that's probably a good reminder.
Hey, kid, do you read me?
Yes, I do, Lieutenant Reed.
I'm double checking the correct procedure for re-entry. We'll be in the Salamis re-entry capsule, which travels at an extremely high velocity, but you just gotta keep up with us, all right?
I understand, sir.
But speaking of Bright, he ends up asking Oscar Dublin, one of the operators, for the position of Char's Musai cruiser, and Oscar reports that it is still on the radar, but there's another ship moving toward the Musai for resupply. And we take a cut to see the supply ship called the Sodon Tug, and it has delivered Char's crew 3 new Zakus. And even though an attack during reentry is risky, with the Federation ship completely focused on reentry, Char sees it as an opportunity to destroy the white base. And again, like we were talking about the animation and stuff, like, this is something that is pretty evident when you watch it. Like, there's a lot of reused animation, obviously, from the original series, but, like, most of the shots with Char, like, when he's giving his, like, pep talk speech in this scene, like, they're all, like, super reanimated to make him look, like, I don't know, either extremely cool or, like, the vision of Char that, like, the Char that he came to be, if that makes any sense. Because I think in, like, some of these sequences, he's very lanky and kind of thin and almost spindly. And I think in the reanimated sequences, he just looks a little more I don't know how to describe it. Like, it's not like he's a fat guy or anything, but he just looks kind of more,
it's like,
more confident, more full figured. He doesn't look quite as like lanky, I guess, if that makes
sense. I just had like a vision of like a really ridiculously like buff Char, like Stan, like he's like, it's like the movie version is how Char remembers it. And he's like all buff and like, he's like, I remember it like I was yesterday. Like I was all buff and my helmet was like super shiny. Like,
yeah, there is that aspect with the animation is newer, so he does kind of look shiny, like, or sparkly, or whatever you want to call it. Like, he's got that kind of cool sheen to him, where it does look a little bit different from like the original animation, like when you cut back and forth between it. But yeah, it's not horribly out of place, but again, like I said, you know, looking at this with a more critical eye, you kind of notice those distinctions and differences.
I just think it, like, I know you haven't seen any or a lot of Red Dwarf, Derek, but it just reminds me of the character Rimmer, where he does like his memoirs and they're all like, since he's like an arrogant little like coward, and like all his memoirs are like key to his like personality basically. So like he's all muscular and stuff and like the like holographic like recollections, and everyone else is like all awful and like skinny and like cowardly and stuff. And it's just like what do you call it? Like the other character Lister, he's like, save us, Rimmer, save us before I wet me cacks. Like, so I just remember like the pilots in that like capsule are like that basically, and Char's like revisionist version of that, those events.
So then, continuing the narrative, Lieutenant Reed, he ends up launching in the descent capsule, and the plan again is for White Base. So they begin to follow the descent capsule in, and at that moment, Bright starts prepping the crew for a possible battle. Another one of the operators, Marker Clan, reports to Bright that an enemy attack is commencing, and Bright then orders the Gundam to launch. Sayla advises Amuro he's got a window of only 4 minutes to deploy, fend off the incoming attack, and return to White Base. And before we go any further, all I gotta say about that is, this is like that 5 minutes on Planet Namek or whatever, where it's like, you know, not quite like, you know, 30 episodes worth, but I mean, this is a long ass 4 minutes. That's all I gotta say. I mean, I know he doesn't actually get back into the White Base, but even by the time they say, it's the point of no return, Amuro, you gotta come back inside, it's been like 15 minutes by that point, it feels like to me.
Yeah. I figured that was working on like Dragon Ball Z time.
Oh, yeah.
Like or something.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally in the it's like, you know, daylight Namek savings time or whatever is going on there. You know, Namek standard time or something. So anyway, Amuro has to engage Char and the three new Zakus. And then Char's right-hand man, Dren, launches in his own capsule from the Musai, and it's called the Komusai, and he fires missiles on Lieutenant Reed's guiding capsule. One of the missiles ends up hitting the White Base. There's some interesting reaction stuff here where it's different between the various versions. Like, I think in the Ocean dub, like, Amuro's kind of freaked out when Sayla tells him, like, that there are four incoming Zakus, and he's like, didn't we just blow up all those Zakus? Like, four Zakus? Am I going to be able to fight, like, four Zakus, you know, at once? But what's kind of funny to me is there's, in the movie dub again, he's very, like, kind of snarky and indifferent, and he kind of goes into the whole, yeah, you know, and it's just like, it's funny how it's too completely different takes on the scene, because I think, you know, Sayla's trying to give him confidence in the Ocean dub, and he seems kind of like frazzled and nervous and everything, but in the movie dub, it's almost like he's kind of like blowing her off. Like, he's like, you sound just like a high school cheerleader, baby, you know. And I'm just kind of like, okay, like, it's kind of funny how he has sort of like a nasty streak in the movie dub.
Is there one you prefer over the other one?
I guess I'm used to Brad Swale, like, because I mean I don't mind him being, because Amuro, I guess, is supposed to be sort of, I mean, there is that aspect where you can see like certain aspects of paranoia in Amuro that are maybe shared in the author, like Tamino. And like, I get that, like that sort of, he's an intellectual, like that's why he talks about that in Char's counterattack and how intellectuals like distrust, you know, and you know, they don't care about like politics and all this other bullshit because they know it's all a big sham, you know. And so there's always that kind of sense that, I guess, you know, it might be interesting to hear because there's probably that aspect to Amuro that's like Steve Ditko Spider-Man, where he's kind of got a chip on his shoulder. So in some ways, you know, maybe you could see the legitimacy of the way the movie, I'm not saying it's like not legitimate the way the movie dub portrays it, but it's just, it's not subtle, you know, like, whereas I think, you know, when Amuro does have those moments of kind of disconnect and paranoia and kind of childishness, it's a little more subtle and earned, I guess.
I see 4 Zakus, 3 degrees, enemy port stern.
4? Char shouldn't have any more Zakus on his ship. Hey, Sela, you sure?
I'm positive, Amuro.
White Base has got to cover me.
Kai and Ryu will cover you with the rear missiles. You won't have to fight alone. Just watch your altitude.
How am I gonna watch my altitude when I'm fighting 4 Zeon Zakus?
I know you can do it, Amuro.
I'm in way over my head here.
4 minutes?
Otherwise the friction will melt and evaporate the Gundam.
Yeah, I know. You don't have to describe it to me.
Keep monitoring your altitude constantly so you don't get captured by Earth's gravity pull.
Sure. What's wrong? I don't have enough to do?
Ryu and Kai will be flying cover. All of us have complete confidence in the 3 of you.
Thanks a million. I only wish I shared that confidence.
I know you'll bring us through this, Amuro.
You sound just like a high school cheerleader.
Stand by to launch.
It's time. Gundam away.
At this point, Amuro briefly engages Char, and one of Char's missiles ends up penetrating his shield. So there's this big hole in his shield. Sela reminds Amuro to make the protection of Lieutenant Reed's guiding capsule a priority. You know, don't spend all this time worrying about Char. Like, make sure the ship that's going to guide us back into Earth's atmosphere doesn't get blown up. And Amuro ends up using all of the Gundam bazooka ammunition. He's firing on and missing Char and all these other Zakus, the 3 other Zakus that are attacking the White Base. However, Amuro is able to take out one of the Zakus that comes up from behind using his Vulcan cannons. Amuro then asks Sela to deploy the beam rifle, but they can only manage to send out the Gundam Hammer. Char fires on Amuro, but the deployed hammer takes the hit meant for Amuro and the Gundam. So I guess I'll just ask, like, this is the first time we've seen the Gundam hammer so far on the show, but I know, like, sometimes Tony will make fun of it because of all the, like, video game stuff. It's like,
Gundam hammer!
Yeah, I can't help but think of that, even though it's supposed to be this sort of impressive mace-like weapon. I guess I always kind of wondered why they called it the hammer as well.
I have a feeling that Tamino like thought this the hammer was like ridiculous, because I don't think it's in the movies. Like, I think he edited this out of the movies.
I think what ended up happening was, like, at this point, he doesn't fight so much with the Zakus as he does with Char, but since they left out a lot of the previous episode's fights, like, they sort of amalgamated them all into one in this moment. So if you thought that this 4 minutes was a long-ass 4 minutes on Namek time, like, if you watch the movie, it's like they basically take, like, the fight he has with Char in episode 3, where he punches him in the gut and kicks him in the side, like, that all happens in the descent into Earth orbit in the movie. So it's like, it's an even longer fight with Char, I think, in the movie version. And I think you're right. Like, I think, like, the stuff with the Gundam hammer and all
that, yeah, stuff. Yeah, G armor, yeah, and stuff like that. It seems like Tamino, like, kind of removed any, like toyetic stuff in the movies.
Yeah, for sure. And at that point, we, of course, go to the commercial break where everybody's going, shoo!
Hey, listeners, Derek WC here from Fanholes Podcast and the History of Comics on Film web series. This will be my review for the Robot Damashii, also known as Robot Spirits RX-78-2 Gundam anime version. Robot Damashii is a line of real robot action figures by Bandai Damashii Nations that are generally in the same height scale as 1/144th scale Gunpla model kits. Technically, this is a reissue of earlier versions of the RX-78 in the Robot Damashii line. Number 078 was released in November of 2010, and number 78-2 was a May re-release that included new hardpoint attachment parts. The anime version, an acronym for Action, New Imagination, Memory, Emotion, is a redesign of the RX-78 with an anime-accurate sculpt that includes improved articulation, a curved beam blade, and effects parts for the backpack and shield. Number 192 is a purchase from this year and was released February 20th, 2016. The RX-78-2 Gundam anime version was originally listed on Damashii Japan's website with the standard retail price of 5,400 yen. I obtained mine via Amazon Prime with a flat price of $35.62. The RX-78 is the titular Gundam mobile suit piloted by the lead character from the original Mobile Suit Gundam anime series, Amuro Ray. While the packaging, by all standards, is certainly collector-friendly, I will say that I prefer the flat-top snapper overlays Bandai Damashii Nations uses on some of their newer figure arts than the more traditional cloned overlay that envelops the tray on this item. The RX-78 comes with five pairs of interchangeable hands and a plastic rack with which to hold the unused hands. The shield has separate parts, so it can either rest on the arm of the Gundam or be handheld with the proper hand type selection. It can also be stored on the rear of the Gundam's backpack. The Hyper Bazooka is also included from previous releases. Unlike the weaponry in previous releases, the anime version does not contain the Beam Javelin, Super Napalm Launcher, or the Gundam Hammer. However, the anime reissue does come with many effects pieces that were not in the original release. The headcrest is replaceable so as to simulate the Vulcan cannons or the 60mm Gatling guns stored on the side of the Gundam's head. Blue rocket fire can be simulated from either the boots or the backpack. The beam cannon has its own specific beam fire blast that can be attached to the beam rifle. Lastly, the beam sabers have similar straight beam effects as in previous non-anime releases, but the coup de grace is the curved beam saber effect intended to reproduce the eye-catch sequence from the original anime series. This is the second Robot Damashii I own, and the first I purchased of my own volition. The other Damashii in my collection, the Master Gundam, was a gift from one of my good friends and Fanholes Podcast cohort Mike. If you'd like to know more about Mobile Suit Gundam, check out Mobile Suit Mondays over on the fanholespodcast.blogspot.com.
But once we come back from that, Amuro basically swats aside Char's next missile attack while Lieutenant Reed's capsule is hit by the remaining Zaku's gunfire. Since Reed is wounded and the capsule is not going to survive re-entry with a penetrated hull, they end up docking in the white base while Kai and Ryu cover them on machine guns. In the movie version, I guess, the fight, again, like I was saying, is a lot more of Char, you know, like kind of, you know, the episode is Vote to Attack. We've previously covered it, but in the movie version, like I said, there's a lot more sort of, I guess, restructuring of those fights and where they show up in terms of the movie and the pace. I thought it was kind of a little clunky in a weird way. Like I guess once you know about it, like once you're paying attention for where these shots come from, like, and looking for it, it does seem a little sort of, you know, a newspaper clipping, like, serial killer thing where, like, they cut and paste what they want to onto the image, but it doesn't quite look right in some cuts. Like, sometimes the edits are a little too fast or a little too clunky, I guess, if that makes any sense. But, I mean, I sort of enjoyed, you know, the fight that was going on here in the actual episode. Like, what did you guys think of this whole sequence? I mean, are you kind of into it? Like, or do you kind of agree with Tomino's kind of distaste of the Gundam Hammer? Like, do you not like the Gundam Hammer?
I think the hammer is pretty wacky. I mean, it's not really even a hammer. You know, it's more like a flail or something, and it seems to be disposed of in the episode fairly quickly. As for the sequence, like, I really like this sequence. It feels really frantic because, you know, they're having trouble, like, even getting, like, the onboard, like, weapons to work to assist Amuro. You know, it's like Ryu's telling the guy to, like, you know, you could at least, like, find the manual instead of whining. I kind of laughed at that. And then it's like, you know, Amuro has to deal with four Zakus, one of which is Char, and then he runs out of ammo and he's, like, he's calling for help and, you know, Shayla's, like, trying to, like, send something to him. And then he has to go and protect the shuttle. So it seems like there's a lot going on he has to keep track of, and he's still somewhat of a novice, and he's kind of like, you know, it almost seems like he's kind of panicking, at least in the dub version, and I did really like this sequence.
Yeah, there seems to be like a combination of things. Like, not only is there a lot going on, but it seems like, at least in this sequence, his equipment kind of fails him, you know, because he does make those comments about, you know, how the trajectory is off, and it seems like his little X-wing fighter pilot kind of lock-on system is not helping him land hits on these guys at all during this sequence. And I don't know if that's just because re-entry is screwing everything up, or if he's just panicking too much or whatever, but because of the, you know, the overwhelming odds of trying to juggle like all these different priorities, whether it's, you know, keeping the little capsule safe, or, you know, making sure White Base doesn't get wiped off the face of the earth, or any of that kind of stuff. In this next moment, basically, we're sort of introduced to Char and the actual pilots that are left, besides the guy who got taken out by the Vulcans. And it's Crown and Komun are closing in on White Base with Char. And when they end up breaching the White Base hull, we get some more kind of like stock animation of the whole, you know, bubble yum sealant stuff. So again, White Base is, you know, getting sealed up because they had their own breach and everything. And my kind of take on it is, you know, regardless of which dub or Japanese language or whatever, I mean, it did really seem like Crown was kind of like this lame brain that like Char needed to like babysit or something, because he seemed like that was one of those guys that seemed like he needed a lot of hand holding. And like you can tell, like, I mean, there's those moments where I think of Tony, because he would often say stuff like this, but like Char's a good leader, like, and he is encouraging to all these people in his unit regardless of their capabilities, you know, and so that makes them better soldiers, I think. But at the same time, like, Crown's attitude and his ultimate fate, I mean, he does kind of just seem like a crybaby.
Yeah, like, I always, for some reason, that scene kind of always sticks out to me, where he's kind of like, or the guy who's like calling out to like Char when the shit starts getting real, like, Commander Char!
Yeah, that's Crown, I think, so. I think he was kind of in over his head, sort of, you know, even though he was out there in the middle of the shit, basically.
Well, it seems like at this point, like, Zakus are kind of, like, rare, but, like, they don't have enough, like, experienced, like, pilots to use them, so it's like they hand them out to, like, these guys who probably don't really know how to use them so well.
Yeah, that's true, because you see that in the dialogue exchange between Char and Crown, because Crown is trying to fire on the White Base, and you get the notion, like, Char is kind of pulling back on his experience. Like, he's like, dude, what, you know, it's kind of like that notion of, like, if Char took out four battleships with one Zaku, like, shouldn't four Zakus be able to take out 12 battleships? But that doesn't necessarily add up, because all these guys are definitely not Char Aznable, you know, like, they don't have his experience or know-how or do daring or, you know, whatever it is, you know, his innovativeness, like, whatever you want to attribute to the reasons why, you know, he was able to be an ace pilot. But kind of like what you're saying, like, he's the ace pilot and he's trying to guide these guys, and he says, look, you know, do this, do that, like, move in and use the power of your Zaku, like, you know, you should be able to take out all these battleships. But again, that guy Crown's like, I don't know, Mr. Char, you know, and it's just like, you're like, oh man, come on, man. Like, the Zaku has the capability, but these guys are not the ace pilots to kind of fully exploit that. There's a brief scene with Kika, Letts, and Katz, and they're sitting with Frau Bo in the White Base while it's under attack. And this is an interesting moment, because Kika basically declares she wants to go out and fight the good fight. And in the Ocean dub, the boys kind of call her stupid and like she's a scaredy cat. And of course, she replies back that she's not. And they're kind of like fighting and everything. I did think it was interesting, like looking at the Japanese language version. It's sort of a little out of context because I think the exchange is like Kika is basically like, I'm going to go out and fight. And in the Japanese exchange, like, I think Katz is like, you know, there's a fucking war going on, right? And then I think Letts is kind of like, it's really scary. And Kika's response to that is, well, I'm not scared. Whereas I think in the Ocean dub, it's more like, I want to go help. And he's like, dude, you're stupid. There's a war. Yeah, scaredy cat. You wouldn't go out and help. And she's like, yes, I would. You know, so it's like, it's a little kind of off, I guess, to the actual intent. So I you know, but I guess it in the final analysis, it's not that big of a deal, but it does sort of change the intent, I think, of Letts and Katz. Like, they're not quite just boys picking on the girl. You know, it's more like, hey, like, there's some real life shit going on out there, and she's just kind of willing to go out there anyway, you know, and they're not necessarily calling her stupid just because she's a girl, you know. It's more like they're just saying, dude, we're scared too, you know, like this is scary. The cadet, I think, that was talking to Ryu earlier, I believe, because in the next sequence, you see a couple of guys in normal suits and they're headed out for the machine gun turrets. And I think one of those guys was Omar Fang, and he's the guy with dark hair and he's got like freckled cheeks. I know it's hard to tell with the normal suit because yeah, everybody kind of looks the same, I guess, you know. And then the other guy is a blonde guy named Job John. So I think this is the first time I've actually bothered to look up those guys' names. Like, I don't know if they ever get called by their name, just like, you know, Oscar, you know, and so it's like Marker and Oscar. So it's like, you know, they don't necessarily call them out by name, but these guys are characters. And I just, you know, since we're going through this and kind of looking at it, you know, blow by blow, I just kind of wanted to acknowledge, like, this is the first time I sort of noticed these guys, but I guess they said they picked them up on Luna 2. So I think they were either we just missed them in the previous episode, or at least this is probably our first introduction to them in the series. I don't know. Did you guys notice these two guys before this at all?
No.
Yeah. So I think this is probably the first time we're seeing these guys. It's like they got sort of a few extra cadets or whatever for their troubles when they stopped at Luna 2.
Yeah. I knew Job, like, he shows up, like, he has minor roles every so often. I don't remember anything like Omar did, basically.
Yeah. It's kind of tough because there's kind of minor characters that play an important role, but they don't always get called out by name or whatever. So meanwhile, Amuro is still fighting with Char. He barely blocks Char's Heat Hawk as it tears through his shield. And then as Komon comes up behind Amuro, the Gundam Hammer is actually doing some good stuff and slams the abdomen of Komon's Zaku. Char decides to use, as Mike likes to say, the power of enough! And the Red Comet elbows the Gundam's head as Komon's Zaku explodes in the background. I thought this was pretty cool. Like, I like this exchange between everybody. I mean, I know you guys aren't big fans of the Gundam Hammer per se, but in this sense, it's obviously not as cool as the Beam Saber doing the iconic slice through of the original Zaku, but it's kind of like a you know, a lesser entertaining version of that, I suppose.
Yeah, I tend to like the Gundam Hammer just because I feel like it's like, you know, he's got a beam rifle, but then he's got a bazooka. So I feel like the hammer is like the counterpoint to the beam saber, basically, like a solid ammunition weapon.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like, kind of like if you run out of bullets, you know, you can go to your bayonet or something like that. I don't know if that's a good analogy or not, but, you know, something kind of like you can hold on to, basically, that's not going to run out of, you know, beam energy or ammunition or anything like that.
Where's Crown? Too late. If we try to recover him at this point, we'll be burned alive.
Oh. Commander Char! I can't seem to slow my Zaku down! Commander Char, please bring the ship and rescue! rescue me!
Crown, your Zaku is incapable of re-entry and we can't open the capsule. There is nothing I can do for you. But listen, Crown, your end won't be in vain. You were able to lure the enemy mobile suit away and ensure its destruction.
Doran, what happened to Crown? We'll just have to forget about him. It's too late to recover him, Commander.
Commander Shaw, I can't slow down! Fuck! There's a response!
I think I've been caught by gravity and I don't know what to do. I've never been in this situation before. You gotta help me!
Crown, we're already too deep in the atmosphere. There isn't time to recover you. Nothing can save you now. I'm sorry, Crown. Your name will go down in history.
So now that they're basically past the point of no return, Shar ends up entering the capsule. Amuro is still outside and fending off Crown Zaku. Lieutenant Reed calls Bright and the white base crew clowns and threatens to have Bright court-martialed. And I guess this is because, you know, Bright sent out the Gundam to fight and everything, and I guess Reed is thinking that they're safe and Bright's jeopardizing that. But of course, Bright's like, hey, you guys wouldn't be alive if it wasn't for me sending out Amuro and the Gundam, so you can shove it up your ass, basically. And at this point, Crown is screaming for Shar to bring the Komusai capsule around to stop him from burning up in re-entry. And Shar is visibly bothered that it's too late to help Crown. And Shar kind of just tells him honestly, look, there's nothing that we can do, but you were able to lure the enemy suit to its destruction. And there's some stuff that I think is funny, depending on which, you know, like, I guess the intent is noble, or, you know, the only thing he can do is tell him that, you know, his sacrifice won't be in vain and he'll be remembered.
I don't remember. What does the Stephen Bloom version of Shar, like, say
in
this?
It's kind of funny because he comes in, like, you know how Shar comes in and asks, well, what's going on with Crown? Like, did he come back in? And, you know, and the Ocean Dove is kind of like, oh, no, it's too late. Like, we can't get him and everything. And, you know, he does the whole thing where he's, you know, his hand is visibly shaken and he's all upset about that. But, like, in this, Dren's just kind of like, yeah, we're going to have to forget about that guy. And Char's like, your name will go down in history. Goodbye. Like, what? Like, so
I thought he was going to, like, chastise him or something.
He's like, you disobeyed orders.
It makes me think of, like, Sound Blaster from that Melee dub. He's like, you know, where he's like, he takes that great standing. He's like, my job is done. Goodbye.
That's what it makes me think of. Goodbye.
Yeah, I mean, it's not quite that bad, but it kind of cracked me up where Dren's just kind of...
He's like, Crown. He's like, Crown, like, if you once you've gone through, like, atmospheric reentry, we'll have to reprimand you. Like you might be a pile of ashes, but
I'll have you court-martialed for insubordination.
So you might think that this is all doom and gloom, and it might even be the end for Amuro and the Gundam, but Amuro basically is frantically going through the Gundam manual, and he discovers that he can quickly deploy a heat film, cooling systems, and other elements necessary for his safe re-entry into Earth's orbit. Meanwhile, Frau Bo and the White Base are concerned for Amuro, but at this point, now that they're going through re-entry and there's all the heat shields up and everything, they can't really observe Amuro's progress. Like, they can't see through the windows because they've got all these metal, you know, reinforcements up for the heat shields. And of course, all the radar and cameras and everything are all hokey and everything when they're going through re-entry, so they don't really know what's going on. And all I could think of is, it's like, you know, Betty and Veronica, you know, it's like Amuro's two chicks are like, Amuro, Amuro, Amuro. It's like the problems of Amuro. Woe is Amuro. You know, like, it's like he may get burned up in re-entry, but he's got two chicks after his job, so he's gonna be okay. But that's kind of my take on the whole thing.
It seems like the whole re-entry into Earth's atmosphere thing, like, that's a popular, like, Gundam trope. Like, it shows up a ton of times, like, in different series and stuff. Like, there's always, like, an episode where it's either, you know, battle in the stratosphere or something, or, you know, they're separated from the ship and they're like, oh no, he's gonna have to, like, undergo re-entry. And then, like, everyone's shocked that the Gundam is, like, strong enough to do it, basically.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like this probably was a famous sequence, probably because it was included in the movie, which was one of the sort of redefining moments for the Gundam franchise besides just being in this series episode. And then it also seems to carry over into like video games and different stuff like that. Like just the moment in and of itself without it being replicated in other series, you know, is like a big moment. Yeah. In and of itself. And then I suppose that ties into the whole notion that this is a real robot anime. I mean, most probably super robot anime couldn't fucking be bothered with the science of reentry. It's like if Mazinger was like on the fucking moon and then he had to go back to Earth, it'd be like, all right, I'm back. You know, like it's not like it was dangerous at all. It's just like, fuck the shit, I'm going back. You know, but this, it's like there's sort of peril and, you know, it's a risk to the enemy who's trying to attack during this moment of weakness. And it's a risk in general, even if they were just landing without being attacked. So you sort of compound all the peril that, you know, the main cast of characters is undergoing and stuff. So, I mean, it's entertaining. It's kind of, you know, you kind of feel the tension and you're on the edge of your seat and stuff like that. But I mean, you know, all in all, basically, like, you know, at that point, White Base makes it through the reentry and restores contact with Amuro, who has also basically made it through reentry successfully. And at this point, Char's alternate plan, in lieu of defeating the White Base and the Gundam, he basically has the notion that he wants to change the trajectory of White Base, sending them into Zeon-occupied territory on Earth. So Char ends up contacting Captain Garma Zabi, head of the Earth Occupation Forces and member of the ruling Zabi family, to let him know that White Base is coming his way. Garma makes plans to deploy an attack Gao carrier to engage the White Base. So, you know, that's basically like what's going on the Zeon end of things. This is the first time we are introduced to Garma Zabi. Of course, he's doing his goofy ass hair twirling thing even from the start. Do you guys have anything you want to say about Garma at this point, since this is like the first moment we've seen him? Like, is this, you know, something you want to share any thoughts on?
It's been a while since I've seen the Ocean dub. I don't know, like, I couldn't like reconcile like his dub voice with like the voice we heard in like the Origin, basically. Mm-hmm. Like, because I don't know, I feel like the Origin is a lot like more suited to the character, where he's like, you know, sort of a whiny, like stuck up rich kid. And I don't know, like the Ocean Group's like, he only has one scene. So maybe, you know, obviously the next episode he'll have more to like work with. But I don't know, it just felt like his voice seemed a little off to me.
Maybe the Red Comet's right. Compared to the other Federation ships I had fought against, this one's a real beast.
It's the Musai capsule.
Good, bring him in.
No way, I'm coming with you.
With this leg? It's broken.
I can still walk. I have to do this, or else they'll think I'm a quitter.
It's funny, like, Iron-Blooded Orphans has both, like, a Garma analog and an episode where, you know, they do the re-entry thing, and they're like, get back to the ship, like, you're gonna burn up, and then the Gundam survives it, and they're like, wow, that guy's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, at the end sequence, there's a nice moment where, like, the evacuees and kind of bringing it full circle, you've got the grandfather with the little boy, and they look through the windows at the Earth, and the boy's like, what's that? And he's like, it's the ocean, and it's basically, like, the first time he's ever seen the ocean, you know? So there's some cool moments with that. And that's kind of basically where the episode takes us out. I mean, you know, some of the animation in that sequence is a bit of new animation and everything, especially like the moments with like Char and Garma. Like I keep saying, like, I guess there's a lot of fan aura for Char because a lot of his animation or sequences, you know, like him talking to Garma, it's like the Garma sequence won't be reanimated, but like the view screen of Char looks like it was slightly reanimated to make him look cool or something like that. So I thought that was kind of funny. But it's kind of the first time, like I said, that I've noticed that at all. But, I mean, pretty much that's the end of the episode. And, of course, the next episode is going to be Garma Strikes. You know, who will survive? And that basically kind of brings us to the end of this episode of Mobile Suit Mondays. You guys have any, like, overall thoughts on the episode? Any other things you want to, like, share with the listeners before we head out for this evening?
I like this episode.
Yeah,
like I said, yeah, this is like an iconic, I guess, like, you know, battle or like action sequence. So like I said earlier, just thinking about it, I was like, man, like this must have been like really like a real like popular part of like the canon, basically, for them to keep revisiting it in other series and stuff.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know me, I like space, and this still has a whole hell of a lot to do with space, even though they're going to be on Earth for a while moving forward. So, I mean, it's an exciting way to get them to, you know, a different atmosphere, a different change of locale and scenery and everything for the next couple episodes. So I'm kind of, you know, of course, you know, we've seen this, but I'm kind of looking forward to the next couple episodes of what comes next, but this was a good, exciting sequence and everything, and I enjoyed it as well. All right, well, I guess that will do it for this episode of Mobile Suit Mondays. If you have any comments, questions, and or concerns, you can email us at fanholespodcast@gmail.com. We, of course, are on the fanholespodcast.blogspot.com. We appreciate any emails you send, any feedback, comments, suggestions. We're on all kinds of social media like Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, Instagram. We can be streamed on Stitcher Radio. You can have access to all the new podcasts, whether they be Fanholes Mobile Suit Mondays, Toku Thursdays, Sentai Saturdays, Transformers Tuesdays, comic books, motherfucker, do you read them? Big in Japan, and the proper Fanholes podcast. So you can, you know, definitely find them all on iTunes. And until the next time, this is going to be Derek WC. What are you guys, some kind of high school cheerleader, signing off?
Hey, it's Mike, and I better read the manual to see how I can, you know, survive re-entry.
And this is Justin. I need someone to bring me a Capri Sun. Stat.
As long as you don't talk while you're drinking it.
Bunch of amateurs.
You bunch of clowns. ただ明日へと明日へと永遠に
What kind of circus you running here, Slim?
It's like, wait a minute, let me read the manual real quick. Backhand in the face.
Yeah, I was gonna say, Bright's like, Lieutenant Reed, shut up! Yeah, backhands him. Yeah. He goes flying off screen. Like, yeah. No, like I don't know. It just was like a weird cut, I guess, but it amused me where they were all like panicking about the Gundam entering the atmosphere, and then it just jump cuts to Amuro like looking through the manual like in his cockpit, and it was just kind of like Amuro's not worried at all. He's just reading like he's leisurely like reading a book while he's undergoing like reentry or something.
They should like cut back to that scene with him where it's all, you know, the cockpit's all red and he's frantically going through the manual, but it's just like the girl from Ipanema is playing in the background. And then it cuts back out to outside, and it's like all the tense Gundam music.
Commander Shar, help me! I don't help losers, Crown.
No, he's like, I guess we'll have to forget about him. Your name will go down in history. I'm like, history for what? For screaming out like a little tool before you die? Gundam Hammer!